All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fuckologists? How are you? Mark Maron here. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. If you're new to it, or I'm in the habit of saying welcome. I hope everyone's having an okay Monday already. Or, you know, yeah, do what you can. God damn it. How's it going? You all right? So today on the show, Alfred Molina is here, which is great. One of the great actors. Very exciting guy. Very exciting to talk to. And of course I talked to him about that scene. Come on. He's constantly working. Right now he's a voice actor on the 10-part narrative mystery podcast, The Angel of Vine. You can get that where you get podcasts, and you can listen to me and Alfred talk in a few minutes. I have some housekeeping, though. I have a bit of housekeeping. A couple of things in relation to the last episode, the Gary Clark episode, which I'm so happy that people enjoyed so much. We had a very nice time. I might see him in Austin. Did I mention I'm going to Austin? Have I mentioned that? I don't know if I've gotten you up to date, but let's do the housekeeping first, which is, I was talking about Jason Isbell, who made a statement on Twitter, which was, old guitars aren't really all that special. And I didn't do any research. I don't know why. I just saw that part of it. But I don't want to misrepresent Jason's view of old guitars, because the tweet he was responding to was, if you were kidnapped and were being forced to tweet so things appeared normal, what would you tweet to alert us you need help? Old guitars aren't really all that special. So it's the exact opposite, which makes more sense. But, you know, I'm willing to believe shit at face value at first until someone calls me out and says, dude, That was an ironic. So I don't want anyone to get the wrong idea about Jason. The other thing, and I'm going to talk about Jason more in a minute. The other thing is that Magic Sam piece that I was obsessed with and am obsessed with, that I played for at the beginning of the Gary Clark thing, which was a conversation we had, it's not called Sam's Boogie. It's actually called Looking Good. And it's actually a cut on the West Side Soul album, which I have, and I didn't realize I had it, and I didn't realize that song was on there, because that live version is just so crazy on fire, and the unlive, not live version of it is a little more laid back, but you know, probably a little more of a portal or a key to how to learn how to play it. Okay, so that being said, while we're in the music groove here, as you know, there have been many musical guests on the show. Many of them have played, and almost all of them, I would say all of those moments for me, are beyond anything I can even imagine. I mean, to have people play guitar and sing right in front of you, literally 3 feet away from me, in front of, you know, right here, and it's just me and them in here, and I'm just on my dumb little mixer trying to make it sound right, trying to make the levels not peak. I'm no master engineer, but I've recorded some amazing people in here, and it's been some of the most amazing experiences of my life. And people have always asked us, me and Brendan that being, about putting together a compilation of these songs, you know, from the show. And we always wanted to, but it's a tricky thing to do logistically. So, good news. We got hooked up with the folks at Newbury Comics, who were interested in doing something with us. And in partnership with them, we've put together, I think, something really special. Record Store Day is on April 13th. And for this year's Record Store Day, we're releasing an exclusive limited edition vinyl album called In the Garage, Live Music from WTF with Mark Maron. And it's got some great performances on it. Okay, these are 10 acoustic performances with Jay Maskus, Melissa Etheridge, Eve from Eels, Karen Kilgariff, Ben Harper and Charlie Musselwhite, Nick Lowe, Margo Price, Jason Isbell, Amy Mann, and Dave Alvin. And I actually play with Dave Alvin on that track. I mean, all these artists in responding to this record were extremely generous in allowing their performances to be featured on the album. And Brendan and I are donating our proceeds to the charity Musicians on Call, who bring music to the patients of healthcare facilities and bring a little joy into their day. So Record Store Day 2019 is happening April 13th. So you can pick up your copy then. Participating stores can be found at recordstoreday.com. And I listened to the test pressing of this thing, and it's pretty, you know, when you heard the list of artists that I just told you about, and like, why, if you put their produced music, you know, from their albums up against each other, it would seem very odd. You know, it probably wouldn't fit together, but they all fit beautifully together because it's recorded in the same way. Very simply, very, I'm not going to say badly, because I use pretty good mics, but basically the setup here is it's the same mic that we talk into. It's an SM7, a Shure SM7. I don't have any effects. I don't know how to use even this very simple mixer. So I just stick that mic in their face, and I stick a mic in front of their guitar. Back in the day, it was a Blue Encore 200, only because I had them. And then I would just sit here, and it's on one track. They're not even separate tracks. I record on one track of GarageBand. So any conversation, it makes it difficult, probably, certainly difficult to do any remastering or work with the song after the fact. But for me and Brendan, it's pretty, even then, you know, two tracks would be nice, but I don't. So all of these recordings are done the same way, you know, except for the Jason Isbell one. So with that as the through line, basically with the garage and my way of recording people, which is very raw and straight up, it provides a connector, and all the performances are relative, you know, or you know, done like that. These are all just people with guitars and a harmonica in the case of Charlie Musselwhite. And they all fit together because you just hear the artist, you know, with a guitar. And I tell you, man, I can't tell you how I like talking to people, of course. But there's also something about these recordings that I think are exactly like what happens here. All these were done, I believe, in the old garage. But these performances were great. And every one of them, sitting across from Jay Maskus with his antique Gibson, just going at it. It's just amazing. Melissa Etheridge is probably one of the most charismatic and moving performances I've ever seen in this place, in my old garage. E was great. Karen Kilgariff made me cry. Ben Harper and Charlie Musselwhite. Charlie Musselwhite is one of the last of the great old harp players. Nick Lowe singing The Beast in Me, because I asked him, great. Margot Price, come on. Amy Mann, just solid. And me and Dave Alvin, Dave being very gracious, letting me play with him. But the Jason Isbell one is the only one that wasn't recorded here in the garage. And I've told this story before, but just so you know, in relation to us talking about music, in relation to us talking about this release of this record, Jason Isbell, I didn't know a lot about him or his music until I realized that we were both going to be doing the same show up in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, I think. We were both on an episode of Wits, that radio show, that podcast. So I got in touch with him probably through Twitter initially, and I said we should talk, and then I got caught up on his work. And then we got there, and I met him at that show, and we did the show, and he'd been on the road for weeks, and we were staying in the same hotel. And that night at about 12:30, 1 o'clock, I went and interviewed him in his room. And then I sat there with him with his guitar. He had a guitar. It was in a hotel room. We're both exhausted. He probably more than me. And I sat in front of him and I held the mics. I held one mic to his guitar and I handheld one mic to his face. And I sat in a chair right in front of him. And he did that song Elephant. And it was one of the most moving musical experiences I've had in my life. It's a very intimate, odd recording, almost like a field recording of a song that is a powerful song and heartbreaking in its own right. But just the intimacy of the recording process was pretty crazy. But that's on there. So, okay. So I guess I'm just telling you my experience with these things. And that album will be available from Newbury Comics on Record Store Day 2019. It's happening April 13th. You can get a copy then, and you can find participating stores at recordstoreday.com. And I imagine that you can go ahead and tell them, if you have a store that you are in relationship with, you can tell them maybe they could get you one. So, yeah, I'll get you up to speed here. Oh, you know what I did? I put the old rug from the old garage up in one of the bedrooms in my house here that's going to be sort of an office-ish kind of space. I unrolled that rug, and I remember I had vacuumed it when I got to this house out on the out in the front yard, and then I brought it up into the bedroom last night and I vacuumed it again. It was just like inches and inches of dust. And I just, I've talked about this before in relation to that fucking rug. But here it is in a new place, in a new home. And all that dust from all those talks, little bits of skin and pieces of dirt from the journeys of my guests. It's just sort of weird. It was like the, you know, the history of WTF in dust. I could make that available. Would anyone like a vial of WTF dust from the, from I guess, skin and hair and things that come off of the guests? Any hundred, I got to assume some of that shit's been in there since the beginning. You never know how the things lodge. A history in dust. But now I threw it away. Should I kept it? What do you keep shit for? Why am I even keeping that rug? I've had that rug forever. It's been through several apartments, a house, and then it ended up in the garage. But, you know, you attach meaning. Yeah, that rug. It's a magic carpet, man. Yeah, man. Magic carpet. I like to. I don't even know the words to that magic carpet ride. But so, yeah, I'm going to be at South by Southwest for a few days this week. The premiere of the film, The Sword of Trust, that I am in. Lynn Shelton film, a completely improvised movie. It was shot, I mean, I think some of you were with me during this. It was shot in Birmingham, Alabama. It was, it's me, Jillian Bell, John Bass, Michaela Watkins are the primary characters. Lynn Shelton directed it and has a small role in it. Dan Backdahl is also in it. Toby Huss is in it. Among a few other people from the area. And we improvised that in about 3 weeks. And now it's a movie, and it got into South by Southwest, and the premiere is Friday night. All the music for the film is music that was played here in this garage or in the other garage. Lynn took a lot of my guitar pieces and layered them throughout the movie. And then the song under the credits, the instrumental under the credits, is something that me and Tal Wilkenfeld wrote and played in a studio with some amazing musicians, Doyle Bramhall, one of them. And well, anyway, so I'm going to be at South by Southwest for just a few nights. And more importantly, in terms of that trip, there, you know, the premiere is exciting, but Opie's Barbecue, Opie's, going to go to Opie's in Spicewood. Always great. So, yes, I'm looking forward to the movie premiere and doing press for that and being part of that. But I don't know. It's pretty 50-50, you know, movie premiere, Opie's. Alfred Molina, obviously one of everyone's favorite actors. Maybe you don't know that, but he is. And it was definitely a great, you know, honor and exciting thing to talk to him. And he lives not far from me, which made it even better for him. You can hear him currently as a voice actor on the 10-part narrative mystery podcast, The Angel of Vine, which is available wherever you get the podcasts. And you've seen him in everything you've seen him in. Go look him up if you're like, who? Because that's crazy. This is me talking to Alfred Molina. How long have you lived up in this area?
Only about a year and a half. I lived in Hollywood before that.
Because you had to?
No, just because it's just where we ended up. You know, there was when we first arrived in the States. We arrived in New York, and
when was that?
That was 93.
Uh-huh.
And I'd been coming here to work. On and off since the mid-80s.
Yeah.
But always just for a specific job or something like that. And this time we came out and we kind of made a conscious effort decision to live here and, you know.
To do the L.A. thing.
Do the L.A. thing. Yeah. But we arrived in New York and we were hoping to stay in New York.
Yeah.
But then my then agent kind of said, oh, no, you know, you've got to be where the action is, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Come to L.A. So we kind of came to L.A. and. But what I didn't realize in my naivety at the time was that LA Hollywood is not the center of the film industry. It's the center of where they make the, it's the center of the film business.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's where the deals are made. It's where, you know, it's not where the work is made.
Not as much anymore.
No, and we could have easily, I mean, I can see now, we could have easily have stayed in New York, which we preferred.
But then you're going to be flying out here every other week.
Yeah, and, but you know what? That's not so bad. I mean, you know, it's not like you know, they fly you and they take care of you.
You can still do it. You can still go back to New York.
I could. But you know, now, of course, I think we missed out. We sort of missed the boat a little bit, I think.
You missed the window to get the to buy the building in Brooklyn.
That's right. Yeah. When things were cheap. I mean, it's mind you, I've always had terrible luck with buying houses like that. I've always seemed to have sold when the market was low and bought when the market was our high. I've never been one of those people. You know, I have friends who are like that, friends who kind of do things like, oh, got this for a steal, and they'll say things like, there's all these buzzwords like, you know, I bought it when it sank, this when it was good.
And aren't they annoying, those people?
They piss me off a little bit because what they're saying, they're not celebrating the fact that they've had a stroke of good luck. They're celebrating and lording it over you of how stupid you are that you didn't manage to do the same thing. It's a kind of modesty brag combined with a sort of slap around the face. It's like, you know, I could do this and you didn't. Right, yeah, it reminds me of that great thing that Chevy Chase used to do when he was on Saturday Night Live, when he would say, "Hi, I'm Chevy Chase, and you're not."
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, "Hi, I'm a lucky fucker, and you're not."
You don't have the foresight or the wisdom or anything. Or the luck.
Yeah.
You can't.
Yeah.
How do you function in the world?
I'm a lover. You're a loser.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But the thing is, like, I don't know about you, but I've only owned two houses in my life, and I live in them. I don't ever think, like, yeah. I always think they're too expensive, the two I've bought. and you carry
the resentment around with you.
A little bit. But it turned out the little one, that went crazy over there in Highland Park. It went like, when I bought that house, I thought, like, this is, who would pay this much money for a less than 1,000 square feet? And, like, what little I knew that, like, now it's crazy. But I buy places to live there. Those kind of people, a lot of people don't get attached to places.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think you know, it's that moment when a house turns into a home.
Yeah.
You know, and it's all to do with, I mean, you know, good luck. You know, when people kind of brag about, you know, how they've made money on houses, that's fine. And I've had good experiences and bad experiences. This is only the third house that I've actually owned.
Right. So you like to live places. You're not thinking like, I'm going to buy this and I'm going to, you're not thinking when you buy it that you're going to sell it.
No. I never think of the house as a possible investment or something that is going to make me money in the years to come. You know,
right.
It's just, I mean, the house in Hollywood, I was in there since 95. I was there for the best part of 25 years.
And you lived in the hills?
Yeah, no, we lived in what was told. The realtor said we were Hollywood Hills adjacent.
Oh, so not the hills.
It was like, you know, we saw the hills at the top of my street. There was suddenly this precipitous rise.
Yeah, yeah, where those houses were. You could see the houses that were in the hills.
And I remember the realtor saying, "And you're really close to Sunset Boulevard, and that's where the action is." You know. And the first action I was aware of on my street, it was, we moved there when the neighborhood wasn't so gentrified as it is now. And certainly within the first week that we were there, in bed, 1 o'clock in the morning, there's some noise outside. I get up, I look out the window, and there's a hooker in our driveway.
Working?
Well, she's making a deal with someone. She's having a little argument with some guy. I don't know. Maybe they were just negotiating the deal. And my wife said, "What's that?" And I knew if I said to her, "There's a hooker in the driveway," she'd have packed a bag and gone.
Yeah.
So I just went, "Oh, kids." You know, because I just knew that she wouldn't have borne that. So, but now it's kind of smartened up now.
When I got my house over in the other place in Highland Park, like within a week, someone had tagged my wall. They'd spray painted. And I was like, holy shit, it's already someone else's territory. What is happening? Yeah. But it leveled off. But you grew up you were in England most of your life. No?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I didn't come to the States until I was in my 40s.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
So where'd you like? What was where'd you grow up in England?
I grew up in London. My background is basically my father was Spanish, my mother was Italian.
What'd he do?
My father was a waiter.
Yeah.
And my mother cleaned hotel rooms.
She was Italian?
Italian, not Italian American. I did an interview once with someone, and someone said, "Oh, where, and your mother was Italian," and I said, "Yeah, she was Italian," and the interviewer said, "From New York, Brooklyn." I said, "No, Italy." She's not Italian American.
And your dad was Spanish?
Yeah,
from Spain.
From Spain. That's right. Yeah, Madrid.
Really?
Yeah, just outside Madrid.
I've been there. I haven't. I was in Barcelona. Do you now
make your mind up, Mark? Yeah,
I'm just trying to seem international. I spent a week in Italy, and I was in Barcelona briefly. I don't know how to speak Spanish or Italian, but I've walked through the areas. So did you grow up with the languages?
Yeah, yeah. My parents, kind of both of them, they had finished their formal education by the time they were like 15, 16. My dad was worked as a laborer in Spain before he kind of joined up with some trade union militia, and he was a refugee from the Civil War in Spain.
Oh, really?
And he arrived in England just in time for World War II.
Oh man!
So he couldn't go back to Spain, so he just signed up. He signed up to the British Army.
So after the revolution in Spain, because he was on the
he was in a trade union militia. He was on the Republican side. He was fighting fighting Franco.
Uh huh. And they got pushed out.
Yeah, there was a lot of refugees who were political refugees. They went a lot of them joined the refugee trail into France.
Yeah.
And from there, they kind of scattered around the world, really. Many went to South America, Latin America. My dad went to France. It's here where the family history gets a bit murky.
Yeah.
He spent some time in France, certainly enough time to learn how to speak French.
Yeah.
And then he ended up in England.
Murky, like a well-kept secret murky?
Well, murky, like no one, I never quite found out what he was doing there. I remember my mother once told me, oh, yeah, yeah, your father was in the Foreign Legion. And yeah. And I think that sounds a bit fanciful to me.
Right.
What I know of the Foreign Legion, once you're in, it's really, really hard. So you can't just pop in for a few months and kind of go, you know, guys, I'm good. So anyway, he arrived in England in top of 39, 1939. My mother emigrated from Italy after the war. She arrived in England in 1947, and she got a job as a chambermaid in a hotel where my dad was working in the restaurant as a waiter.
Oh.
And that's where they met.
So they'd pass each other in the hallway.
And, I guess. Yeah. As they were changing into their outfits.
And he stayed in that job his whole life.
His whole life. Yeah, he was a waiter, bartender. He was a restaurant manager for a while.
It's a certain deal in England. I guess when you have your health care covered, and also there's a union to it too, isn't there?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. So like, yeah, I mean, this was just after the war. It was really the beginning of what became known as the welfare state.
Uh huh.
You know, where you had universal health care, a free education, all of that stuff. And I mean, I think I may be part of the last generation in England who I got educated from the age of 5 to 25, and I didn't pay a penny.
And it was good education.
And it was a good education. I went to good schools, parochial schools. They were Catholic schools.
Yeah.
And I went to drama school. I got my degree at drama school. And you know, and that was it. I mean, all I had to find was like my pocket money. You know,
right.
But all my tuition, all my school expenses were all covered.
It's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
There was no shame in the working class then.
Not at all. There was, in fact, quite the opposite. There was a great deal of pride. You know, there was a movement after the war. There was a movement where the working class had a kind of profile, and people were, you know, it was clear that there was many, many talented people in the working class, and all that they were lacking, they weren't lacking the skills or the talent or the ability. What they were lacking was the opportunity.
Right.
And that was given to them by successive governments after World War II.
But it's always, it strikes me like in growing up in England that you do, there is sort of a class system.
Oh, completely.
And no one talks about it here, you know.
Yeah, but there's a class system here too.
Oh, absolutely.
But I think the difference between the systems in a way is that here it's a meritocracy here. I mean, it's all about whether you have money.
It's a meritocracy, but it's also what the merit could be is just your ability to bullshit and hustle.
So it's not, make money.
Yeah.
And make money.
Right. I mean, if you can make money, then it doesn't, seemingly at this point, especially with this president, it doesn't fucking matter how.
Yeah. I'd say here's the thing. Here's the difference that I this is my theory.
Yeah.
When you talk to an American, when you're talking to someone from America.
Like me.
Yeah. You hear the accent.
Right.
Now, all I can tell from your accent is I can maybe have a vague guess at where you might be from.
Hmm.
But your accent doesn't give me any information about your education, your financial status, how you were raised, or anything like that. When you talk to a Brit, all that information is in there in their accent.
In seconds.
You can kind of tell, you know, he's middle class, he's working class, he's upper class, he's had an education, she hasn't.
Yeah.
You know, you can. There's all that, and it's all subtle, it's all subliminal, but all that info is there. And as Brits, we respond to it and act on it.
Yeah.
You know, so someone comes in, I remember when I was a student, constantly being told about, you know, you've got to neutralize your accent. Otherwise, my first agent actually said to me, you really got to calm down with the London accent, because otherwise you're going to be playing Spanish waiters all your life. Because my name was Alfredo, you know, and he was saying drop the O or change it.
It was that obvious, London was a bad accent. Yeah. What was the preferable accent?
It was like when I went to drama school, my accent was a lot more kind of a lot rougher than it is now. I mean, I sweetened it up, you know, because I took his advice. This was 1971.
It just sticks, or are you putting on an effort now?
No. This is now how I talk, but I think that's after years and years of, you know, kind of
like what did you used to sound like?
Well, it was all sort of a bit like that, you know, a bit kind of thrown back in the mouth, you know, a bit kind of, you know, oh, hello, Mark, you know, all right. But of course, now when I do it, it does feel to me affected.
Yeah, when you do your old accent.
Yeah, but when at the time, it was just the way. I mean, every now and again, my daughter said to me once, she said, Dad, when you get, so I can really hear the London when you get angry.
Oh, there it comes, yeah.
Because it goes from this to kind of like, I fucking told you. How many more times?
That's interesting. That's what it comes out. It's still in there.
It makes sense because we all, you know, at those moments of high emotion, we always betray ourselves.
You know? Right. Or you betray yourselves, but you're probably being more honest on some level.
Hmm.
Yeah,
that too,
you know, like then that's when people go, "That's who you are."
Yeah, that's the real Fred Molina.
See it now,
you faker.
But so, what was the education? Where'd you go to drama school?
I went to the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, or as it was known then, the Guildhall School of Screech and Trauma.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very good education. You know, it was a kind of classical education. It was, this was the very early 70s.
But were you doing it in high school or whatever you call it?
Oh, yeah. When I was at our version of high was secondary school.
Yeah.
I went to a Roman Catholic secondary school for boys.
Were you very Catholic?
No. My parents sent me there just in case.
In case what? Yeah. There was a God?
Just in case there was a God. You know, my parents were not what I call kind of, they were like part-time Catholics, you know.
Well, Spain and Italy, those are big Catholic strongholds.
I mean, they were raised Catholic, but they weren't practicing.
Right.
In fact, if anything, my father was actually very anti-clerical.
Yeah.
He had some experiences during the Civil War that kind of really kind of turned him off the church.
Catholic fascists?
Yeah, all the Catholic fascists.
Yeah.
And my mother was just, you know, so they sent me to a Catholic. No, I was baptized.
Right.
They sent me to a Catholic school.
Right.
But that was partly because it was a good school and it was the nearest one to where we lived.
Sure. You know, my brother went to a Catholic high school and he's a Jew.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah, my parents' choices weren't quite so stark, but I get it.
Yeah, there was some point where my brother went to like some school and he came home singing a song about, you know, Jesus loving him. And my parents were a little taken aback. Had to sort of set him straight with the vague notion that we don't do the Jesus thing. We're not sure what we do, but it's not that.
It's not. That's right. I remember coming home from school one day. This was primary school.
Yeah.
I was younger than 10, certainly. I remember coming home and telling my dad that one of the priests or one of the nuns at school had told me off because we didn't go to mass.
Yeah.
And the nun had said something like, well, you know, you're going to, you know, there's a good chance that, you know, people who don't go to mass will go to hell.
Yeah.
Something like that. And I told my dad and he hit the roof. I'd never seen my dad. It was scary, actually. He was like screaming and shouting in Italian, Spanish, and he went down to the school. He went down to the school the next day, and he kind of just was screaming at the headmistress, and just, you know. And after that, I was.
What was he screaming about?
Well, he was just basically just saying, you know, don't talk to my son this way.
Terrorize the kid.
Say these things to my kid. Yeah. You know, sort of. I remember he said something about, I know about you people. I saw things in Spain. He told me this story.
Yeah.
That he had seen in the bowels of some church, he had seen. Sort of the bones or the of babies,
mm-hmm.
And he believed this may well have been just him swallowing, you know, propaganda.
Yeah,
but he said that these were the bones of babies who had been born from nuns,
uh-huh.
And how they'd been killed and kept there secretly, or you know, all this kind of weirdly wacky stuff. But then I remember thinking, oh come on, you know, he's probably exaggerating.
Yeah,
but then of course you talk to kind of hardline Catholics. And you kind of know that there's all that shit in the background, you know.
There's layers and layers of
And you kind of and you start thinking, well, maybe
yeah, there's just
maybe there were elements of truth in that. But anyway, on that day, he was absolutely furious. But the irony, of course, was that he scared the bejesus out of me because he was so angry. But when I went back to school the day after, I was like the hero for a couple of days. You know, yeah, your dad, yeah, your dad told Mary, Sister Mary Kevin, that she was an old asshole. So I was like, you know.
You started a revolution.
Yeah, I was on the cool kid for about, you know, a day.
Yeah, you fought the fight against hell.
That's right.
So, but you were acting then?
No, I didn't start.
Not at 10, but it
No, not at 10. But I know that. Around that time, we used to do this thing in school. It was, I think it was just a way of filling the last hour of the Friday. We used to do this thing where we would kind of put on little shows. And I just remember doing a little skit that I'd worked out with my chum.
Yeah.
And getting a laugh.
Right.
And, you know, and this is a story you hear a million times from performers, you know.
That first laugh.
The moment.
Yeah.
That you kind of go, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is it. Now, I had no idea. You know, my mother told me once that I was 9 years old when I first said, I want to be an actor. But I can't believe for a moment that at that age I had any idea of what it implied or what the, you know, what was involved.
Right. You were just a showman.
I was a show-off.
Yeah.
I was a show-off. And in fact, years later, when I was doing my first leading role on Broadway.
For which play?
It was a play called Art.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And it was a huge success. And my old drama teacher from high school, who I'd stayed friends with, this guy was a very, very, very important part of my life. And he came with his partner to come and see the show in New York, which I was thrilled about.
From England.
Yeah. And I took him and his partner out to dinner with another friend of mine who happened to be in town. And my friend Andy turned around to Martin and said, so, Martin, when you were teaching Fred at school, was he a good actor? And Martin instantly kind of went, no, he was a dreadful actor, but he was a marvellous show-off. So that's how I started. I was a terrific show-off.
What was great? This guy's name was Martin?
Martin Corbett.
And he just encouraged you?
His first day at school as a teacher was my first day there as a student.
Uh-huh.
And he came in as, I think he was deputy head of the English department. And one of the first things he did was he started a Wednesday night drama club, and he started teaching plays and putting on plays at the end of each semester. And of course, I was happy as a pig in shit. I mean, I thought it was just the most fantastic thing. I lived for those Wednesday nights.
It's weird how like that one guy or that one teacher in high school can change your whole life.
He did. He was the first adult, apart from my mother, who I sort of confided in and said, I want to be an actor. And Martin basically said, okay, I'll do whatever I can to help you, but the minute you drop the ball, I'm washing my hands of you.
What does that mean?
Basically, what he meant was, if you're serious, I'll be serious and I'll help you.
But in high school.
Yeah, but if you're being flippant or you don't put 100% effort into this, I don't want anything to do with you.
Wow.
I was a little taken aback by that approach, but actually I really appreciate it, because he gave me reading lists, he gave me things to look at, he suggested plays I should read, movies I should see.
Really? What?
Well, kind of just stuff that was appropriate and that would help me understand what being an actor was going to be like.
But you would never know about them hadn't he told you.
Not really, no. Yeah. I mean, he's in that, certainly not the plays. He said you need to start, if you're serious about being an actor, you've got to start reading plays.
Shakespeare?
Yeah, Shakespeare, Noel Coward, George Bernard Shaw, all that stuff. Stuff which in the normal traffic of events probably I wouldn't have been exposed to.
Yeah, you need that guy.
Yeah, he did things like when I auditioned for drama school, for instance, in my last year at school, I got a place at drama school, and then I auditioned in front of a board, the local education authority, for a grant, so I could afford to go to college.
Yeah.
And I forgot my lines in the audition, and they turned me down.
Oh,
so I was heartbroken. I went back to the school. I told Martin what had happened, and he wrote a very impassioned letter to the board saying, please, this young man is talented. Give him another chance. He was nervous. I guarantee you he'll be spot on next. And he really fought for me, and I got another audition, and I passed, and I got my grant.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, what movies did he make you watch?
Well, I think it was things like, I can't remember the title of it now, but there's that wonderful movie with Tony Curtis and Sidney Poitier about the escaped convicts.
Oh, yeah.
In the Heat of the Night, yeah. He told me to look at movies like Lawrence of Arabia, and all these comedies, all these Ealing, these were like old movies, which would turn up on TV. So he said, make an effort, watch these movies.
Was it the Defiant ones?
Defiant ones,
right.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't believe I remembered that.
And I'm thankful.
My brain rarely works. I just want to make it clear I did that without Googling. I did that.
Yes, I can verify that. I'm sitting directly opposite him.
Did not touch my keyboard. I just remembered that. It's a real, it's a rare thing. So, all right. So, but like the education, like, I mean, you've done so many different roles and you're constantly working.
touch wood. That's been the case. I've been very fortunate that way.
But like, what was he, because I do a little acting myself now, and I know my listeners get tired of me now that I'm acting a bit, and whenever I have actors on, I'm like, so what's your process? So, but the education is, because I didn't have any of that education, but I mean, you were classically trained.
Yeah, and it was, and I, that was the kind of, that was the traditional and accepted and expected journey, was to, go to drama school and get trained. And then,
but that was Shakespeare, the classics?
The most contemporary play that we actually worked on in my drama school was written in 1939.
Mm.
Everything else was before that. It was all kind of, everything we looked at was in the classical canon. But that was the way that drama was taught in those days. And I mean, now it's very different.
Sure. But like in doing that, you know, what exactly, what paces are you sort of walking through that stay with you? I mean, like, you know, when you're just doing, if you're doing Shakespeare or you're doing, I don't know, you're doing Greeks too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, what does that program in your brain?
I think what it gives you is an understanding of the history of the tradition that you are now joining.
Right.
You know, and it's a bit like, you know, it's a bit like the old adage about, you know, breaking the rules is great, but you got to know what the rules are first.
Sure, sure.
And I think that's essentially what it is. You know, you in order to kind of express and kind of break new ground, you have to understand how that ground arrived there in the first place.
Right, or else you're just a cheater and an idiot.
You can't be trusted. Or you don't have a context for what you're doing. You know, it's you know, I remember the first time I heard very kind of out there free form jazz, Cecil Taylor,
sure,
people like that, and I didn't get it at all. I'm kind of going, what is this? It just sounds like people just kind of making noise. And then it was a friend of mine who was a jazz fan said, no, you got to understand, these guys, they could play you anything you ask them to play. They've journeyed here to get here.
Journeyed to fuck you.
They haven't just landed and kind of gone, hey, what's this, a saxophone? What does this do?
But this, you is know, the 70s, you said?
Yeah, I was at drama school from 72 to 75.
So when you get out, I mean, is the heyday of experimental British theater, it's already going.
Oh yeah, there was when I came out of drama school, there was a very healthy alternative theater circuit and a theater scene. There were lots of small companies kind of applying for project grants and so on, and they were doing some really interesting work. There was a big explosion in feminist theater, in kind of gay theater, alternative theater. There was loads of these wonderful disparate voices, people making work, making theater. You know, sometimes they do it in a garage, or they do it in a small little black box somewhere in the middle of nowhere. They would tour, you know, touring art centers, working class, working men's.
Did you do
social
some of that
club
stuff?
Yeah. I worked with two companies. One company was called 784, and the other company was called Belt and Braces. And we took shows that had a very strong political content, and we took them on tour to colleges and working men's social clubs and stuff like that.
And what how was the reaction? I mean,
the reaction was depending on the quality of the show.
Right.
The reaction was good. Sometimes it was not so good. We did a play. For instance, with 784. With Belt and Braces, I did the original British production of a Dario Fo play called Accidental Death of an Anarchist.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
And that was a hugely kind of successful. We had a very successful tour. It went to the West End eventually, but without me. It was a time when there was a lot of public money available for art,
yeah,
in all its forms, art, theater, music, you know, for fine arts. There was a generosity with state money.
Yeah.
And that started to shrink once Margaret Thatcher became prime minister. There's always a blossoming of public money for the arts whenever there's a Labour government in power.
Yeah.
As soon as the Conservatives get back in, it all starts to shrink again.
And did you find that in Britain, that there's more of an audience for theatre?
There is, very much so, very much so. There's an audience for theatre. There's an audience for good theatre, certainly, because, you know, the British enthusiasm for theatre doesn't mean that they'll take anything. You know,
right.
If anything, they're quite fussy.
Yeah.
You know, I remember going to the theater in New York with an English friend of mine, and he said, I've seen five shows this week, and every single show, there's a standing ovation at the end of the show. And to quite honestly, Fred, one of them deserved it. The other four certainly did not. Because in England, in London, you know, audiences don't stand up. They stand up if it's really exceptional. I think you get a standing ovation if you turn up.
Yeah, if you get through it.
If you get through it, it's like everyone's on their feet cheering you.
But I guess that's also part of that tradition that you sort of learn when you do classical stuff and you do Shakespeare, that there is that, it all started there. So like there's like, you know, centuries of what it sort of invented theater in a way.
And also now that theater's become, you know, theater, I think somewhere along the way, in the modern era, somebody, I don't know who, and I don't know when, but somebody somewhere suddenly said, you know what? This can make money. This is, right. this is a good workable business model. And so people like Cameron McIntosh, who was, you know, an independent producer that I worked with, they started putting money into the infrastructure. You know, they started renovating theaters. So making the whole experience of going to a theater much more pleasant.
Yeah.
You know, when I was a kid, going to the theater was a bit of a challenge because the theaters were a bit grubby.
Right.
They were run down. You know, you couldn't get a drink in the interval. You know, the ice cream came in these tubs and it was weeks old and warm. Yeah, you know, there wasn't much care.
Warm ice cream.
Kind of basically like a thick milkshake.
That's really bad.
Yeah, it's disgusting. but that started to change. So now, you know, you go to the theater now in London and major cities in England, and it's a great night.
What was the big break? I mean, were you gunning for television work?
No, you were
going to be a theater guy.
Yeah, that was the thing for my generation. Theater was always the first entry point for work.
You didn't even think about like how to get in movies.
No, movies and TV was something that was way ahead in the future that you had to kind of like work towards.
Right.
You had to sort of, in a way, kind of get well known enough or earn the chance to do a TV or a movie.
And who are the elders in, you know, for your generation, you know, in the theater world that everybody looked up to?
It was people like, you know, Glenda Jackson,
yeah,
Trevor Nunn.
Yeah,
you know, we had some great actors, Donald Sinden, Peter O'Toole.
Yeah,
there were actors who were like maybe 10, 15, 20 years ahead of us.
Yeah,
who were doing great work, and that was what we aspired to, and the idea of getting into the National Theatre or getting into the Royal Shakespeare Company, working with, you know, really good provincial companies like the Bristol Old Vic or the Exchange Theatre in Manchester and so on. That was what you aimed for.
Yeah.
But it was always theatre because that's all we were trained in. I mean, there was no, when at my drama school, the most technological class was a class that was rather vaguely called radio, microphone technique.
Yeah.
And that was it. There were no classes about screen work or how to audition for camera.
But at that time, not unlike, I guess, the thing you're doing now, this the Angel of Vine podcast, that like the BBC had radio plays.
And in fact, in those days, they may still do it. The BBC had a repertory company.
Yeah.
And the BBC Radio Rep. And every drama school was invited to enter a competition. And so every drama school would send maybe two or sometimes three of their, you know, best students to enter this competition.
Yeah.
And you would basically audition for the BBC Radio Rep. And if you won, the prize was a 6-month contract with the BBC Radio Rep. Now that was like, I mean, that was serious.
Yeah.
That meant that if you won this,
yeah,
you'd leave drama school and you'd be in a job. You'd have a job, a paid job for 6 months.
Talking.
You know, and it was like, that was, and so we all went and did it. We all kind of tried to do that.
Did you win?
No.
I did a radio show for the BBC in one of their old hall. Like they have like those, even the BBC in that building, you know, I'm in this room that has an audience in it and it has its own history. You're like, a lot of shit happened in here. You know, there's like not a tradition, but it's all in one place. There's very few places like that here where, you know, that's where it all happens. When you have a national radio, the studios are historical.
That's right. That's right.
And so much has gone on.
Yeah.
There.
And I remember the very first time I worked at the BBC to do a radio job. I was told that the studio we were in was where some really famous science fiction series from the 40s had been transmitted.
Yeah.
When it was live, and you would find all these sort of old actors who were radio stars who did almost nothing but radio, and they'd be full of little hints like, you know, dear boy, when you turn the pages of your script, just hold it away from the microphone, and perhaps try and fold up the ends of the pages so you've got something to grab, just a little hint. And they'd give you all these little, and of course at the time I was young, I loved all those old guys. Those old guys were, you looked up to them. They were the elders. They were the actors that had been through what you were going through, had experienced what you were hoping to experience, and what they, and their knowledge, their understanding, even their cynicism about it was useful.
And also there was it sounds like in Britain there was a working class element to that.
Oh, very much so. Yeah, very
like these
much
these guys,
so.
You know, they had jobs for a lifetime.
It was Peter O'Toole and Albert Finney's generation.
Yeah.
They went to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art and they just kicked the shit out of that place. I mean, you know, they were the ones that were kind of going, "No, I'm not going to change my accent. You don't like my accent? Don't talk to me." You know, they had the guts to kind of just challenge all that.
Did you get to work with either of those
I got
guys?
To work. No, I didn't. I became sort of friendly for a while with Albert Finney because we had a couple of mutual friends.
Yeah.
I never got to work with any of those old guys, but they were the people we were kind of. They were the people we adored, you know, because they walked the walk and talked the talk.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, and they lived the life.
They did, very much so, very much so.
I mean, there's a lot of lessons from that you might want to avoid.
That's right. I worked with a wonderful old actor called Sebastian Shaw, who was a great character actor and leading man at the Royal Shakespeare Company when I was there just kind of spear carrying.
Yeah.
And
Is that what it's called?
I was a spear carrier, yeah. And lantern bearer. You know, like a lot of young actors, you know, when you're talking to older actors, you want to know, so you want to. Yeah. And I think I said to Mr. Shaw, I think I said something like, "Mr. Shaw, do you have any advice?
Yeah.
For me, I was kind of a bit gushy, and he said, "Yes, I have." he said, "I'll give you some advice." He said, "Never stand when you can sit, and never sit if you can lie down." And at the time, I thought, oh, he's just an old fart, you know.
Yeah.
But now that I'm in my 60s myself, I'm thinking that's really good advice. So thank you, Mr. Shaw.
It's practical.
Totally.
So when does how does the big break reveal itself? Or I mean, in terms of when did you start working?
Well, I was always working. Not always doing what I wanted to do, or not always doing necessarily what was the best thing to do.
But that's just part of your work ethic.
I grew up in a family that really lived paycheck to paycheck.
Was your dad on board with the acting?
Not really.
No,
not really. He thought he was a little, he was a bit bemused by it. And then I think he became slightly irritated by it. And then he just dismissed it, you know, because it didn't seem to be of any consequence.
He didn't get to see any of your success?
He got to see a few things. I mean, he never quite was able to express any pride or any enjoyment of what I did. There was always a caveat. It was always kind of like almost begrudgingly acknowledging what I was doing. But then, of course, after he died, I discovered that he had a suitcase, like a big bag.
Of
and
clippings.
It was full of clippings and posters and articles and photographs. You know, he couldn't actually, you know, I remember one of the last things he saw before he passed away. I did a play where in the second half of the play, my character is in full drag.
Yeah.
Because that's his job in this. He's in a gang that's his job in the heist is to kind of like, you know, deflect attention.
Right.
So he's in full drag on a street corner pretending to be a lady of the night. And my father comes to see the show, and afterwards he says to me, "Alfredo, it was incredible. When you dress up as a woman, you look just like your mother." And I was thrilled by this, and I kind of went, "Oh, did you think I was attractive?" And he goes, "Don't be ridiculous." So that was the closest I got to a compliment when I was in drag, I looked like my mum.
Why is it with that? What is it with fathers and that thing? Like, what is the obstacle?
Well, I don't know. I can only speak from my own experience. I don't know. I'm sure there's a million and one reasons why fathers do that with their sons.
They can't express their pride.
I think with my dad, it was because I think what I was doing, what I was the way I was living my life, you know, what was important to me, he just could not understand. I mean, he got me a job just after drama school. He got me a job in the restaurant where he was working.
Yeah.
He was bartending by this time. He was bartending in this restaurant, and he got me a job as a waiter. And if I say so myself, I was quite good at it. Good enough that my manager asked me if I'd be interested in going on a paid 2-week course, which the restaurant would pay for, to train as an assistant manager.
Yeah.
Now, if waiting tables or if working in the catering business had been my ambition, that would have been like a great thing to do.
Yeah.
But I turned it down because I wanted time to go to auditions and stuff. And when I told my dad that I turned it down, his disappointment was palpable.
Yeah.
And but I don't think he was disappointed for me. I think he was just embarrassed, you know, because I think he thought that it made him look as if he hadn't raised me properly.
Right. Well, also
or
there
somehow something like that, you know. When I left that job and took an acting job, which was paying me something like a third of what I was earning as a waiter, he could barely.
That was it.
He could barely talk to me.
Yeah, he just didn't understand your choices.
Didn't get it.
So, what was Oklahoma the first big thing?
That was the first big. Sort of stage production that I got involved in. Yeah, and that was the one that kind of got me a little bit of attention.
That was like in the '80s.
That was nine. Yeah, that was round about. Yeah, because it was round about when my daughter was born, so it would have been like, 1980, 81.
So it's like, I don't know anything about the production, but I know it got a lot of attention, and mm-hmm. It was
the first major revival of the musical since like the 1950s.
Yeah, it's sort of odd that it got so much attention. What was it about that production?
Well, I think it's because it was very popular, that the show's very popular, and it was the first time, there hadn't been a production of Oklahoma for nearly 30 years.
It was like some sort of unearthing.
It was like a big deal. And we took it on tour first, and then we came into the West End. And also we had this young Australian singer, John Dietrich, who was absolutely brilliant in the role of uh-huh. Curly. It was kind of a big deal. It ran for a year and a half. I did like 10 months in it.
I wonder what the appeal was. I guess it's Britain, and Oklahoma is very specifically American.
But it was a huge success when it first came over to England. And there's always been a great...
What, in the 30s, you mean, or whenever?
When it came over. It came over in the late 40s, I believe. And I think that was the last time we'd seen a production of it in the West End.
I don't know the show, but like musicals are this a whole other, their own thing.
Well, every number in the show was a hit.
Yeah.
Over the years, every number in the show had either been released as a single or had been part of famous singers' repertoires. So all the numbers were a hit. My character, I played Judd Fry, you know, the bad guy. He has one song in the original musical, which was cut from the movie. So every night when I went on stage, every other song, as soon as
people were singing along.
They were either singing along or as they heard the opening bars, there was a kind of a round of polite applause, you know. Oh, what a beautiful, I'm just a girl who, and then of course I come on and my song starts, dung, dung. It's really dark, you know. The floor creaks, the door squeaks, you know. There's a mouse a nibbling on a broom. It's all very kind of dark and, you know, paranoid. And of course, when that starts, I could see the whole audience kind of turning their heads, kind of going, "I don't know this one. What's this song? I've never heard this song." And every other song in the show got like cheers at the end, you know. Yeah. People will say we're in love. The place goes mad. Yeah. I end up with in my lonely room. Nothing. Tumbleweeds.
But you stood out.
I stood out. It was a real kind of learning experience.
And that started the theater role?
Kind of. And then it was just after that that I did my first movie. And then
movie was that?
That was Raiders of the Lost Ark. You've really done your research, Mark. Yeah. I'm really impressed.
Yeah.
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
I don't know. Sometimes I talk to people from...
And you've never heard of them.
We Wikipedia is not always great. IMDb is good, but sometimes I talk to people. It's like, well, I did this little movie that you can't find on there. Yeah, but no, that was a big
Matrix.
Yeah, no, that's a big movie. I remember you're the guy with the spikes coming out of you.
Yeah, that's right. That's
It was very disturbing. My producer, I think it scarred him for life. He's like, he said,
work here is done.
For most of his life, you were that guy because he was a kid. It's like that's the guy who was.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's right.
So you get booked out of England for Raiders?
We did, yeah, because in those days, shooting the studio system in England was very economically depressed at the time.
You know,
the studios were empty. People weren't shooting there. You know, the British film industry was going through one of its cyclical downturns.
See, I might want to add real quick that here on this particular resume, it says that there was a movie before that. And that, you know, and
what was that?
It was A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square.
That's erroneous.
See? That's why I played stupid.
That's erroneous. I've never done a movie called. I don't know what that is. I've got a feeling.
It says you're uncredited, and it's a port official.
I know what. No. I've got a feeling someone's got. I think that was the title of an episode of a TV show I did.
Ah. Wikipedia, you can't count on it.
You can't trust them. You can't trust them.
So the film industry is very depressed.
It was very depressed, and so it was very cheap to shoot in England.
Yeah.
So basically what Paramount did is that they brought their whole production office over to England. They'd already cast Harrison Ford and Karen Allen from the States, but every other actor in the movie was cast in London. As a consequence, we were all working under British equity contracts, which did not include any residual payments.
Really?
No. So we all got paid like a lump sum.
Was that a plan?
That's just the way it was. Yeah. We never had a residual system in English film contracts. You just got paid your fee, and if you were a star, you'd negotiate a big fat fee, and that was it. That's what
really?
You got. Really? Yeah, I mean, I think it's slightly changed now, but certainly in those days. So we were cheap.
Yeah.
We were very cheap.
But
also very grateful.
and then you were doing British television as well?
Yeah, I did a little bit of TV, but still even after the movie, I was still, you know, regularly working in the theatre and regional theatre and in London. I mean, it was just the films really didn't become my main stay of employment until I came to live in the States.
But for years you were sort of like one of those guys, like there's that guy again.
Oh yeah. I suddenly was on that track of, you know, the character actor.
Right.
You know? Oh, isn't that what's his name? You know, which I've never complained about. I mean, it's
a better way to be. It's a better way to work.
Yeah, that life got to, you know, put two kids through college. I have no complaints.
And you don't have the pressure of, like, you know, you got to be, you know.
That's right. I mean, you know, there's a great, I've told this story often, but there's a great quote of the late Bob Hoskins, who said that he loved popping in and out of movies, you know, doing little cameo parts.
Yeah.
And the reason he loved it so much, he said, when you turn up, they're happy to see you. They treat you like the crown jewels. And if the movie sucks, nobody blames you.
That's right.
And it's perfect. Yeah, it's
but what? But then you had big, like, Prick Up Your Ears. That was a big move.
Yeah,
a big part.
Yeah, that was a nice. That was a nice big lead in a what was then a very prestigious, very. That was a movie that very much kind of pushed the envelope socially and politically. You know, it was the first time that we saw. A gay relationship, albeit a destructive one, but a gay relationship portrayed as a relationship and not as some kind of, you know, secretive criminal, you know, kind of endeavor. You know, it was the opening up of a whole new way of telling a story. You know, and of course it was based on true events and everything. So that was quite an important moment.
And such a disturbing character.
Very much so. Yeah. Very much so. I mean, that was the first time that I actually spent a lot of time before shooting actively researching the role and the history of these two characters. You know, Gary Oldman and I, we'd been friends, and, you know, we'd done a play together, and we spent 3 or 4 weeks just every day together, just kind of working out these timelines of, you know, where these characters were at any particular moment. So when we arrived to shoot the movie, we kind of felt very much at home with the characters and with the events of the story and so on. And that really taught me a great lesson, you know, and that's something that I've continued to do whenever I've worked on, particularly when I've worked on films where I'm playing a character who actually existed at some point.
Well, that and I would imagine too, like, because you did do you played Mark Rothko in Red,
yeah,
and that he was a complicated character,
very much so, yeah, and interesting. The more complicated they are, the more contradictory the information you get, the more interesting it is to play.
What do you mean contradictory?
Well, in the sense that there used to be an exercise at drama school that we used to do,
where
you would write down a list of all the things that your character says about himself. And then you write a list of all the things that the other characters say about your character.
Right.
And the best writing is often when those things contradict each other.
Yeah.
You know, if a character says, oh, I'm just an ordinary person.
Right.
You know, I'm just, you know, and then someone else says, oh, my God, I saw him the other day. He was drunk and dancing on a table.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of contradiction, you think, oh, there's some interesting stuff to work
right,
on.
There, right,
you know?
Right, yeah.
Because in real life, we're all contradictory. We're constantly contradicting ourselves. And so that was, you know, so with Mark Rothko, you know, I read all the stuff that he'd written about his work. I read
the Breslin biography?
The Breslin biography, which is absolutely definitive.
Yeah.
Plus, Christopher Rothko, Mark Rothko's son, Christopher, has written a fantastic book, which is a kind of analysis of his dad's work and where his dad was at in his life at any particular time. So all of that stuff was very, very useful and very helpful. But ultimately, the last thing an audience is paying for is to watch an actor schlep his his homework on stage with him, you know.
Yeah, so you have to integrate it somehow.
Yeah, what I do is you absorb as much of it as that is useful and then forget it.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, all you're doing is really recreating what's on the page.
Right.
You know, you can't suddenly decide to rewrite something because you happen to know what he had for breakfast in 1959.
But you believe that it goes in there and
I think it lodges itself. Yeah, it becomes part of your, I don't know, I'm going to sound terribly highfalutin now, but it becomes part of your creative DNA.
Right.
In some way.
Right. And that's something you've done, now you do it all the time.
Yeah, and it becomes kind of second nature in a way. You know, I mean, of course, if you're playing a purely fictional character, then of course, you know, it's just your imagination you just need your imagination.
Sure.
You know?
So like, so you're going back and forth from England to the States, but the play Art brings you to New York and you stay in New York.
Yeah. But I was already living in the States when I did Art, but then that was the first time that I'd worked for a long period of time in New York.
And that was a huge show. Who's that? Who's in that? Garber?
I did it with Victor Garber and Alan Alda.
Yeah, yeah,
great company. We all became good friends, and we've remained so.
Alan Alda's a good guy.
Oh, fantastic! I mean, and he was like our dad.
Yeah,
in a way, he sort of took Victor and I under his wing, and there's a wonderful moment when Alan was always very, very keen on, you know, on like finding a new restaurant, you know, and he loves food. He was always very excited to find a new place, and he came into work one night and said, "Guys, there's a great new Italian restaurant. It's and he mentioned the name of the chef.
Yeah.
He said they've just opened downtown. I'm gonna get my assistant," and he gave a name. He said, "I'm gonna get my assistant so and so to do it." And I said, "Oh, I thought so and so was your assistant." And Alan said, "Well, I've got two assistants, one here and one in the office." I went, "Oh," and then I said something like, "Wow, Alan, that must cost you a fortune." And Alan very quickly said, "I've got a fortune." I loved that. He was just.
And how do you, you've done a lot of movies. Some of them I've seen. Some of them I haven't. Like some of them I forgot I saw. But you work with when you work with somebody like Jim Jarmusch.
Yeah.
Like I'm trying to remember how big the part in Dead Man was.
It wasn't very big. It was basically one scene. I had one scene in the kind of trading post
where
Johnny Depp and Gary Farmer come in, you know, and there's this kind of, negotiation, which gets very tense. And that was the only time I went up to, he was shooting it in somewhere in Oregon. And I went up there for a week and I was there for 3 or 4 days not doing much. And then we shot all that stuff in like one day. And then a few years later, Jim called me, and in the interim, I'd worked with Sarah Driver, Jim's partner, and I'd done a film with her in Germany.
Which one was that?
It was called When Pigs Fly.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And starring Marianne Faithfull.
Oh, which, wow.
She's an interesting woman, really interesting.
Yeah, I used to see her. I worked at a coffee shop in Harvard Square when she was drying out at some point in the late 80s, and she used to come in every day, and she looked weathered.
Yeah, but an amazing woman. I mean,
yeah,
really
she's
kind of
great.
So many stories, so much. Anyway, so, and then after that, Jim called me up about coffee and cigarettes, and he'd been making these little vignettes for years, trying to find a way of somehow putting them together. And he just said, I've got this idea for a little short. Would you be interested? And it was myself and Steve Coogan. And I said yes straight away because, you know, I'm a big fan of Steve Coogan.
He was just here.
Oh, cool guy. Really fantastic. And Jim just basically said that he didn't have a script. He just had an idea for a scene.
Yeah.
And so we improvised a lot of it.
Was it fun?
A lot of fun. And we didn't improvise in front of the camera. We worked it all out the day before in a rehearsal, so we had a pretty good idea of where we were going to go with it.
Yeah,
but I'd never worked that way before. I'd never done a movie or worked on a film where there was so much freedom to just kind of invent stuff and just kind of, you know, and that was really exciting.
Have you done more of that since?
No, I haven't. It's funny. It was like finding the most delicious dish in a buffet.
Yeah.
And just thinking, you know what, I'm just going to have that now. And then you go to another buffet and there's nothing like it. It's not there.
I think you and Coogan should work more together.
Well, we had fun. I mean, I hope Steve's memory of that film is as fond as mine is. But I mean, I remember for instance, we did this whole we got into this whole riff about his coat.
Yeah.
Which was a conversation that we'd had literally a couple of hours before in the lunch break.
Yeah.
When I'd said something like, that's a really nice coat. And he went, yeah, it's a Vivienne Westwood. I said, that's cool. And then, so in the scene, I just kind of went, nice coat. And then he just went off on this whole thing. It was brilliant. I thought this was such a great way to work.
It's fun, right?
Yeah, I loved it.
In the moment.
I loved it.
It's hard to get in the moment. So, like, I just read, the weird thing is we could spend a long time with a lot of the stuff in the resume because he's done so much, but I just read an article recently, like 3 days ago, about your scene in Boogie Nights. Like,
wow.
It was like a New Yorker scene. Someone sort of like, how does it hold up? And you know, and there's a reference to that scene. And I have to assume that no matter what you do, a lot of people are never going to forget that.
Oh yeah, that comes up a lot, and I'm delighted. You know, I've never understood it when actors kind of get a little irritated when people kind of mention iconic stuff that they've done.
Right.
You know, you hear actors kind of saying things like, oh, I wish they'd stop talking about that movie I did. You know, that never bothers me because it's those moments that, you know, in a small way, I mean, it may be a footnote in the history of film, but it's there.
Yeah,
you know, and it exists, and I'm very, very proud of it, very proud of those things. You know, like when you know people come up, I mean, people still say, I mean, usually men of a certain age, will say things like, you know, I'll be in a bar or something, or in a restaurant, or in a line in the coffee shop, and someone will come up and say, "Throw me the idol, I'll throw you the whip." Huh? That's you, right? And I'll say, "Yeah, that was me." And then they always say, then they always apologize. They always say, "Yeah, you must hate that when people do that."
Yeah.
And I always say, "No, I don't hate it. I'm delighted. I'm delighted that you remembered it. I'm delighted that it's part of your kind of, you know, memory of things, nice things. I'm delighted by
that." But that's also the great thing about, you know, going back to Bob Hoskins' talk, is that when you have those moments where you're not the whole movie, but you can really be in that moment, that those are the ones that people really remember. You and the boulder.
That's right. Yeah. I'm very happy with the billing you've given me, by the way. I came before the boulder. So I'm delighted. But you're right. I mean, it's not, I don't think it's anything to be ashamed of. It's nothing to be embarrassed by, you know, and then, you know, other people might talk about Boogie Nights it delights me. I find it flattering, and that they remember, and I'm delighted that it's a positive memory. You know,
and it's a great movie. But would they?
He did the most wonderful thing.
What?
T.T. He did the most wonderful thing when Boogie Nights was released.
Yeah,
he went to the trouble of calling every single person that was involved on that film to thank them for their contribution to it. And I don't just mean the actors. I mean crew, you know, people who weren't on screen. He you know, that movie was a huge thing for him. And he just called everyone. I thought that was such a classy thing to do.
Thinking back on that scene, I mean, like in terms of how you put together a character, you know, what was that work?
Well, the story goes, I'm not sure, I've never been able to corroborate this, but the story goes that the part was already cast.
Yeah.
And the actor who was cast at the very last minute dropped out.
Yeah.
The story goes that this actor's reps got wind that this movie was about pornography and stuff, and they right. You know, maybe you shouldn't be associated with it or something.
Yeah.
And so he dropped out. So I got a call from one of the producers, John Lyons, who I knew when he was a casting director, and he said, "Look, I normally wouldn't do this, but you know, we're in a bit of a jam. Would you be interested in coming playing this part? It's only going to be like a couple of days' work."
Yeah.
Turned out to be about 3 or 4 days. And I had just come back from a film. I'd been away for a long, long time. So I was really happy to be working in LA. And I said, sure. And then he said, well, I'll get Paul to call you. So Paul calls me and says, okay, this is the part. He's a coked up drug dealer on a shotgun rampage. And I went, yeah, I'll do it. Because I was thinking, I've never done that before.
Yeah.
So I said, yeah, I'll do it. Yeah. And then he sent me the script and he explained who this character was, how it was loosely based on this character that actually existed.
You Nash.
He was based on someone. I think Eric Bogosian in another movie.
I think his name was Nash, yeah. But he was like Armenian or Iranian or Israeli.
Yeah.
The club owner guy.
Yeah, and yeah. he was kind of into drugs and porn and stuff. And yeah. So, but I thought this is going to be great fun. Fun to do. And it was, we had a wonderful time.
I think he played him in the John Holmes movie.
Was it Wonderland?
Wonderland, yeah.
That's it.
Oof, that's a disturbing movie.
Yeah, very much so.
But that set must have been crazy.
It was a lot of fun because PT was very inventive. The scene with, you know, with the crackers,
yeah.
You know.
Firecrackers,
He told the young man who was playing Cosmo, you know, the young kid who was like lighting the firecrackers. Yeah. The firecrackers were full bore. They were like, you know, they weren't damped down. So, and he said to this kid, just light them any old time. Don't worry about continuity. Just light them whenever you want to.
Yeah.
Which, of course, the sound man just kind of went nuts, you know, because how do you? But right. But he had a good re. What he wanted to do is he wanted all the actors except me to be really genuinely. Sort of struck by them.
Yeah.
So whenever you had a shot of the three, you know, Thomas Jane, John C. Reilly, and Mark Wahlberg on the sofa, and they're jumping every time, that was for real because they didn't know when it was coming. You know, this guy would just light them and just throw them, bang. But in order, and I said, well, how am I not going to react? Because I'm going to be hearing. So what they did, they plug, one of my ears was plugged up, and the other ear had an earwig in it.
Yeah.
So I couldn't hear anything. All I could hear was dialogue.
Right.
So for me, every firecracker just sounded like, very kind of vague, faint in the background noise, which I didn't react. So they're all jumping out of their skins, and I'm walking through the scene like I can't hear it, like oblivious, like in this coke cloud. And it was such a brilliant idea. It was so brilliant. And it created this weird... There was this weird energy in that scene, you know.
Yeah, because you're
everyone
just,
else is like freaking out, and I'm just floating through it, like you know, like I'm oblivious,
singing.
Which I was.
Yeah,
it's just singing. I loved it. We had such a good time.
It must have been.
There was
a
there was a John C. Reilly did an interview somewhere, and he said, and he was being asked about that scene, and he said, "Yeah, we were just sitting on the sofa watching the Alfred Molina show." Which it kind of was.
Yeah. It was a good show. And you worked with him again on Magnolia?
Yeah, yeah. Had a nice little part in that. That was interesting. And, you know, I love his work. You know, I was a fan. You know, I'd seen Hard Eight, you know, his first movie, which I thought was fantastic. So this was I said yes even before John finished his first sentence, really.
Yeah, and what, like when I saw Spider-Man 2, where he played the Dr. Octopus.
Yeah.
The thing is you bring something sort of like so visceral to like almost anything you do. Like that guy seemed almost
like, I mean, the way you played it was like it was almost Shakespearean somehow. Like, it,
well, that's very kind of you.
But you know, it was so like,
is that a nice way of saying over the top?
Right. but that's good. It required that.
Yeah. Well, it was partly that was that. I'm glad that came across because that was partly to do with Sam Raimi. I think what he wanted was something otherworldly somehow. He wanted his villain to be in the same way that in the first one, Willem Dafoe's villain in Sam's first Spider-Man movie, had this kind of larger than life. He had a kind of he had a style.
Yeah,
you know, and I think Sam was into that, you know, and so it was. But that was another amazing experience working in a way that I'd never worked with before. I'd never done a movie that was so technically complicated before.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, it was, and all the CGI and the animation and all the technology that was employed in that film was at a level that I'd never experienced before, and it was exciting. It was like a real. It was like making movies in a whole other way I'd never done before. So it was.
Did you have to wear arms?
Yeah, well, there was a huge rig that was operated by puppeteers. There was another rig that was on cable.
Wow.
There were some of the shots were animated and CGI'd and stuff. I mean, whenever there were close-ups and I had the arms, you know, behind me, kind of oscillating very, very gently, that was all because, you know, the puppeteers were giving it life. They were this is the interesting thing. The puppeteers that were operating the arms were actors themselves. Huh. So they were kind of, they were giving the arms a kind of, I don't know, a kind of personality.
So each arm had its own thing going.
We ended up calling them Harry, Larry, Flo and Mo.
You named the arms.
We named the arms Harry, Larry, Flo and Mo, yeah.
Do you get excited about every job?
I do. Yeah, I do.
Because I think that's what reads more than anything else. You're not just like...
I haven't lost my joy of it. And I think it's partly because I'm, you know, I know this is where I might sound a bit sentimental, but I look at my family and what they had to do in order to allow me to do this. You know, they may not have understood me all the time, but they made sacrifices on my behalf.
Yeah.
And so I feel... I'm conscious of that, and I'm aware of it, and I'm thankful and grateful for it, and it's given me. They gave me a chance to, in a way, to live a dream,
right?
That has become a very nice way to earn a living. It's given me a lovely life. It's given me it's given me the chance to be part of a wonderful community.
Yeah,
you know. So and I love going to, I love my, you know, I say to people, I love my tribe.
Yeah.
You know, I'm proud of them and I'm proud to be part of it.
The actors.
Yeah. Anyway, anyone who works in
show business.
In show business, really.
And you do it's crazy. I mean, you do like voices, you're on Rick and Morty, you've done a bit on Drunk History, show up, like, you know, you do, like, if you've got a few days, you'll go do it.
Yeah, I'm a bit of a slut that way. I mean, I find it very hard to say no.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've said no in the past, but it's usually when it's really, really bad. But, I mean, it's luckily, I've always managed to find something that I've enjoyed in the work I've done.
And you guys resurrected Red in last year?
Yeah, we did it last year because we never did a West End run. We'd done it on Broadway. We'd done it in L.A. We did it in a small theatre in the Donmar in London, which is officially regarded as the West End, but it's not like a proper West End house. It's kind of small. It's only 250 seats.
And how was it? Good?
It went great. Yeah, we did. It was a big hit.
How much of it was still in your head?
Not a lot of it, actually, to be honest, because it had been a good 8-9 years since we'd done it before. But once I started working on it and relearning, and you know, it big chunks of it were coming. Yeah, so it was all there.
Yeah,
it just needed to be kind of dug out a little.
It's interesting,
you know?
Right?
Yeah, I was amazed. I was grateful for that because I, looking at the play, I remember how kind of hard it was to learn it in the first place. I was every night I was giving it a couple of hours of just homework, just drilling the lines to so they were just like would come easy.
Yeah.
And then I thought, oh, God, I've got to do all that again. You know, but actually it started to come back. But it came back in, it was really interesting. It came back in these chunks.
Uh-huh.
And my problem was working out how to put those chunks in the right order.
Yeah.
It's like you have all the ingredients and you're kind of going, well, what goes in first, the onions or the peppers? I mean, you weren't quite sure.
Yeah, you just got it through repetition.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And you played Diego Rivera too, so you've done a couple artists.
Yeah, yeah.
You've never played Gauguin though.
No, I've never played
Gauguin. You look kind of like him.
I know. Well, you know, somebody sent me a painting of Gauguin.
Yeah.
Like a self-portrait.
Yeah, no, that's the one I'm thinking of.
And he sent it to me with a little note saying, look familiar.
Yeah, it's like the whole side of his head and some of the
Tahitian
stuff in the background.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I thought, yeah, but I've never been asked to play him.
Oh, maybe one of those. I think there was.
Let's get on that, Mark. Let's get on to
okay,
that.
Okay, I'm making note of it. So let's talk about, let's finish up by talking about this podcast.
Yes, Angel of Vine.
What is that?
Well, basically, it's a 10-part podcast, and it's a combination of like L.A. Noir.
Uh-huh.
And a little element of time travel,
yeah.
A little element of documentary.
Yeah.
The premise is that a stash of tapes are discovered.
Yeah.
And the tapes are of a long-retired police officer on the LAPD in the 50s working on a case that was never resolved. And it's him recording his interviews, his encounters.
Wait, is it a murder case?
It's a murder case, yeah. It's,
from the 50s? So it's like True Detective kind of?
Kind of, and it's loosely based on the Black Dahlia story.
Oh, that was earlier though, no?
Yeah, but it's got this kind of, it's got this sort of, you know, the tapes are discovered, and it's how this character starts working on the tapes and going through them and gets caught up in this case and wants to try and solve the case, sort of, like a case, you know, going back in time through these tapes.
Yeah.
And so it's got this lovely, it's got all those elements and it's radio theater.
Yeah.
You know, the people often use these euphemisms like it's a movie in your head.
Yeah.
It's a film that's going on between your ears.
Yeah.
But what it is, it's radio. It's radio theater.
Sure, what existed before television.
Yeah, in a very kind of classic form. Yeah.
That's what's amazing about this medium is that all of these forms, which were the primary forms of entertainment.
Yeah.
You know, before anything.
That's right.
The
great gift now, of course, is that we have mobility, which means that you're not stuck sitting in an armchair glued to your radio. You can hear this anywhere.
And do you guys record as a cast?
Yeah, we recorded as a cast. We record I did my scene with Joe Maniello, you know, in front of me. Which is kind of unusual because very often you record on your own.
Yeah.
But this scene was so kind of intense that it was, you know, Oliver Vaquer, who's our writer and one of the producers, he felt that it was important that we could see each other and play off each other. And with that made a big difference.
Yeah.
And now, of course, it's all, you know, now all episodes are available.
Sure.
You know, wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah. Just download them and go ahead.
Yeah.
Enjoy your drive.
Exactly.
Have a good time at the gym.
This is the thing. I'm hearing this a lot now. People are saying that they love their podcast because they listen to them on their commute.
Oh yeah, man.
You know, and it's a habit that I've started to get into now.
Yeah.
I'm downloading podcasts now and listening to them while I'm driving.
Sure, people do it at the gym. They do it at the commute. They do it secretly at work.
That's right. Yeah, I'm busy.
Yeah.
Put your headphones back on.
Well, it was great talking to you.
Oh, thank you, Mark. Likewise.
That was fun. And are you? You were great in Vice too. That one scene. You had the
thank
one
you.
Sort of high satire scene of of that movie. Did Adam just call you up?
And Adam called because I'd done some work for some work before with Funny or Die, you know, those guys, and he just called me and said, you know, he said, I've got two parts, they're not big, but either one is yours.
Yeah.
And I looked at the script, and I loved the script, and I said, let me do the waiter.
Yeah.
You know, because that's in and out. I mean, literally in and out. So, and I said, let me do the waiter and I'll do it without a credit. You know, so hopefully it'll be a nice surprise. And if it's not, no one will blame me.
Again, Bob Hoskins rule.
That's right.
But so there's no credit?
No, so I don't get credited. No, I'm not credited.
What do you? Are you working on a movie now?
Yeah, I'm. There's a couple of movies. In the, I did a film called "The Devil Has a Name," directed by Edward James Olmos, who's who's a chum. And that will be out. That's due out this year. There's also a movie called Saint Judy, which with Michelle Monaghan, that we now think it's going to be released round about middle of February, end of February. I played a part in it, but I was also executive producer. I was one of the executive producers on that. So there's a couple of films in the can, and I'm working on a movie that I hope to direct later this year.
Have you directed before?
Never. Oh. Never. Perhaps that's why no one's returning my phone calls. But I will persevere.
Okay. Is it something you always wanted to do? Or
it is. It is. And I've left it. I haven't left it too late, I don't think. But I've certainly, people say, you've never directed before. Do you think you can direct? I said, well, I've been on enough movies to know that I know what not to do. Let's put it that way. I think I know how to avoid mistakes. And I know how to run up. I know what makes a day not go well.
Yeah, it's all about the DP.
Yeah, it's all about the DP. It's all about the DP, and it's all about your assistant director as well.
Right, AD and the DP.
Yeah, that's
the, and then you just pretend that you don't let anyone see how confused and frightened you are.
That's right. Yeah, and there was one thing a director I worked with. I said if I was to direct a film, what would be your one piece of advice? And he said, always have a decision. When people ask you what you want them to do, always have an answer, even if it's the wrong one.
Right, right.
He said, the worst thing you can do is kind of go, I'm not sure. What do you think?
Then nobody knows.
Yeah, yeah. Mr. Molina, where do you want the camera? There.
Yeah.
Even if there is totally the wrong place. Because someone will say, are you sure? And you go, no, I'm not sure. Here. at least have you. If you've made up your mind about something, at least it's reassuring.
Right, sure. They know someone's in charge. All right, man. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
That was great. I learned some things that I didn't know about that scene. Yeah, how genius was that? Again, Alfred is you can see him in everything he's ever been in, which could take a lifetime. But he's also the voice actor on the 10-part narrative mystery podcast, The Angel of Vine, available wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget as well, studies show that security systems deter burglars, which is why securing your home is truly a necessity. At Simply Safe, they believe fear has no place in a place like home. So they make Simply Safe ridiculously smart with 24/7 monitoring for just $14.99 a month. So go with home security you can trust. Simply Safe by heading over to simplysafewtf.com today. That's simplysafewtf.com. It's early in the morning, and me getting excited about a new angle on an old riff probably made my neighbors hate me at 8:30 in the morning on a Sunday. Okay, here we go. Boomer lives.